Today is February 27th, 2011, and I'm at the home of Terry and Mary Ann McMullen. Today I would like to interview Terry McMullen on the Yukon Charlie Ethnographic Overview Project. And I have some questions that are that I'll use to ask the questions and just want answers to you from you. And if you don't want to, you have a option of not answering and some of the questions, and that's legal. But what I want to do is I go through this one and we'll talk about the questions that they want me to ask you. But after that, I'd like to do this a short interview, maybe half hour, 45 minutes, on some of your use of the Yukon Charlie and your use of the area since you've been there.
Okay.
So my name is Isaac Unaby, and I am now going to start interviewing Terry McMullen. Part 1A is historical overview, personal background. Where were you born?
I was born in Red Wing, Minnesota.
Where were your parents born?
My mother was born in Red Wing, Minnesota, and my father was born in Cashton, Wisconsin.
Where were your grandparents born?
My grandparents were all born in, my grandparents were born in, one in Wisconsin, one in an Ohio River Valley. And my other set of grandparents were born in Minnesota, down around the Mississippi River, little towns called Rolling Stone.
Where were your great-grandparents born?
Ireland. One set of grandparents both came from Ireland, and the other set came from France and one came from Germany.
I guess on the next question it asks, what can you tell about the origins of your family, people, and in number four, I think you answered that already.
That's about as far back as I can go in my...
Are there any old beliefs, customs, traditions practiced by you or your family that remains important? If so, might you be willing to describe them?
I don't think anything, out of the ordinary,
What crafts or a specialized activity do you do?
As far as was relationship to the river or around here? Personal life? Or?
Yeah, well, I think when the question is, what can you relate to me that you do that is very useful of the Yukon Charlie or something,
I've always fished here in summertime. I've always run a fish net. I used to run fish wheels for quite a while, and now I use fish nets. I've been a dog musher and lived in the woods, for several years. And as far as the local culture, that's really it.
I would like to add in this question too, just to elaborate that Terry did a lot of things back when he was young that you kind of followed the old custom of native ways, didn't you? In learning about the country.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I came into the country as a school teacher in 1967, and I taught in Eagle Village for 3 years. I was the first state teacher there after the school was taken over, the administration school was taken over from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and it was a one teacher school. We lived in one wing of the school, my family and I, and I got to know, of course, everybody in the village, and got to really be interested in the village culture, and I learned a lot from everybody out there, especially the old timers that were still there, the generation above mine actually, which includes your dad, mm-hmm. Isaac, and some of those guys, and you know, that's I picked up a lot of interest in the river, in the culture of the river.
Well, you're actually been on the river quite a bit of time in the summertime, right here.
Yeah,
so you know,
yeah.
You know pretty good the navigation.
Yeah. Actually, from that time, summer, you know, I spent most of the time on the river in the summers, either here or down, of course, around the 70 mile, mouth of 70 mile where we lived, and then hunted down there in the fall, and all the way down in usually the Nation, below Nation is where we generally hunted. You know, before the park came into being, and Wood Island, you know, hunted a lot there, so.
Yeah, in number 8, Terry, it asks us almost the identical same questions as you did up here, so I'll just ask you, but, you know, how would you describe your identity, such as your belief, ancestor, your culture, your connection to the land and community, your land, or your combination? I believe that you answered it out there by when you first came in, you went into the community school to teach, and that was your
right.
Big deal. But that you also partook in a lot of the activities, the seasonal lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I think that too, you know, a lot of these questions we can answer by one sentence, but if we elaborate and tell, I think that's what would be very good. You know,
mm-hmm.
Saying,
okay. Yeah,
well, I was here, I cooked on that fire. I mean, just an example of what you actually did, you know, this is what is really interesting. What else do you identify with yourself and your family?
Well, you know, this is appropriate, but you know, when we moved down there after I taught for the 3 years, then we moved down into the country, down into the 70 mile, mouth of the 70 mile river, and we stayed down there, and you know, I have four children and my wife Mary Ann, and we lived for many of the years in the 1970s, that decade we were down there, and we basically lived the life that you know, most river people did. With regard to hunting and fishing, and picked a lot of berries, you know, had a garden, cut wood, you know, taught the kids at home. And we'd stay over at Ford Lake in the springtime, what villagers used to call springing out. You know, we'd go over there and had a camp over there, and, you know, and had hunting camps down river. Head of Wood Island down at Nation, hunted all the way probably in those years down as far down as the Charlie Creek, Candick River, and yeah, that was that.
I might elaborate on that too, is that knowing Terry all these years, that your family, your kids were born, actually they weren't born out there, but they adapted into it, and they are pretty well, they could adapt to anything, dog, mushroom trapping, hunting, fishing.
Yeah,
hunting,
kids got into that, and
yeah.
They did it. They, you know, they were, yeah, they really adapted and really enjoyed it. So.
Historical overview, community background. What do you know about Eagle's distant past?
Well, I know something of Eagle's past because I've only, you know, through the oral history that I got from the villagers there, and I used to, you know, I could really spend a lot of time with a lot of the old timers that I knew, listening to them and listening to their, you know, their background and where they came from, things they did, things they had, you know, the way they had to live, the way they lived, and basically their culture, and remember enjoying that. I'm talking about, you know, the old timers that again, Isaac's dad and that that generation all the way back to, you know, I was fortunate to have Eliza, old lady Eliza Malcolm, still alive when I first got here, and you know, she was well over 100 before she died in the 80s, so listening to those people, you know, that's where any knowledge I got of that, you know, came to those days, really.
How have mining activities in the area affected life in Eagle?
Well, you can see evidence of the mining industry around Eagle, you know, the past mining industry. You know, you can go to certain areas out in the bush, like up in the 70 mile, in areas that have been really mined for a long time. You can see evidence of that and what the land, what, you know, the, how the land was changed because of it. And then there's been some, you know, close-in mining, where people still mine, still prospect. And I don't know if you could say it's ever offered that much economy to the local, you know, the local economy or not, but people have, you know, still go out and do it. And of course now with the price of gold up, it's kind of like it was in the early 80s when the price of gold went up, and there was a lot of other mining activity that went on because of that. But it's never been a stabilizing, you know, force in the economy, local economy, that I can see. But I've known in the past of the Coal Creek and where the dredge were and was, and there's been a lot of activity that benefited the river country for sure.
I like to note here that people may not know that, but a lot of the mining in the Eagle area and all the tributaries on the Yukon River, a lot of that were the aftermath of the Klondike Gold Strike. I mean, people moving to different areas because all the land were taken up there. So that's why we have the mining within the Eagle area, 70 miles.
Well, a lot of people don't realize it either, but you know, there was people on the 70 mile prospecting before the Klondike even was struck, mm-hmm. you know. And in fact, a lot of the 70 mile in some of the research I've seen, and you know, there were people that were had claims on the 70 mile river in the late 1880s, 1890s, and before the Klondike was struck in 96 or 97, whenever that was.
Well, one of the times I was down in the area of firefighting, I saw a claim on Duke Creek. That's way back in. Mm-hmm. We saw a claim in there, me and Jake Malcolm. We saw the claim with that. Are there any old stories about floods that you know about?
Well, the only one I know about is which I heard from, you know, the villagers when they were still around and stuff, and that was the one in, I think it was 37. And the Nelly, you know, the Nelly, I think, was probably the last one that really has a good memory of it. But I remember guys in the village, and I think one of the stories that came out of that, I think that was the year it flooded downriver, and Harry David and was it Charlie? Your uncle. I think it was your uncle. Charlie. Silas.
Charlie Silas.
Charlie Silas. I think it was those two that was down there cutting wood, and they were out on Wood Island, and they ended up tying themselves up in a tree with their belts. Yeah, I remember. I mean, I heard that story. And then, of course, I remember hearing from Ole Hansen, who was teaching out in the village then, about it, how the village was flooded, and it went all the way back to the hills, and they, you know, people went back in canoes and boats and got out of the village that way.
On that same question too, is that I've heard the stories. I don't think it's much of a written material, that prior to even 1937, way back when, there was a flood. And at that time, I think this Eagle Village was separated some of those ponds down below. So the way I heard it was that some of those Hans went to Circle and some of them went up north to Fort Yukon area. And to this day, they do have a few Hans up there.
Yeah, sure.
In Arctic Village or Unitai, and then in Circle, that's part of Hans. So I think what happened is that when the flood came, that kind of was a barrier. So the Eagle had to go down this way or go up this way.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. And I could kind of see that, you know. And because there's, I think our territory at one time was pretty huge, you know.
Oh, I would imagine. Yeah. I would imagine.
What role has the church played in the development of Eagle?
Well, you know, as far as I, you know, from what I know about both Eagle and Eagle Village, that the main church around here was Episcopalian church in the early days, you know. Definitely part of the social fabric, you know, of the town and the village. And the local church here in town still is in the, you know, now, which is a different church. But you know, that's of course now with the populations down, both here in the village, there's not any the major, you know, organized religions as such aren't here anymore, although I think they do time to time some people come in and hold services.
What role has the school played in the development of Eagle?
Eagle schools go back a long way, you know, as far as the city, of course, when the city was founded, whenever that was, 1901 or whatever, you know, they've had a school here ever since, one form or another, and of course the school out in the village, which was a Bureau of Indian Affairs school, and I don't know how far that goes back to when they first started having schools up there, but 1967 the state took over the administration of the school, and then about 76 or 77 Alaska school districts were formed, and the Eagle community, both all of the area, went into the Gateway School District.
How do you feel that life in Eagle has changed with the coming of new residents?
Well, I think what's changed, I don't know about the residents, but what's changed Eagle and the whole area, I think, has been technology. Along about the early 80s, I think we saw our first, maybe our first telephones here. There were one or two phones that were here in the town, and maybe one in the village, and then pretty soon the television came to being, you know, then satellite, and then, of course, then the internet, and that, I mean, yeah, the internet especially, and that's really made changes. I don't think, of course, it's gone from a wood-burning town to a stove oil-burning town, combination of, and I think being able to communicate not only locally but with virtually the rest of the world has changed more than anything else.
It might be interesting to note here too is that a lot of your new residents, as we call them right now, right here in this interview, is that a lot of them have come in from wherever they were, and they're part of the community right now.
Yep.
And you have a few people coming, moving in, but majority of Eagle is those that just stayed years and years and years. They're just settled there. And then once in a while you get somebody that at one time they called the river people that are now moving in, you know,
yeah,
because of their kids going to school or because of something in their...
Yeah, yeah. There's people in Eagle now, you know, that
yeah,
have been kind of the last of the, what were, like you say, the river people from the 70s. Most of those people moved on and out, and but some stayed around, and yeah, pretty soon their kids are in school, and this is where they're, I mean, this is where they're home now, so.
How do you think that tourism has affected the community of Eagle?
I think tourism now, more so than ever, there's always been some tourism in Eagle because of the road, you know, but I think the tourism now with the boat that runs between here and Dawson is, you know, I think there is that helps the economy here in the summer, and there's several people that I think do make, you know, part of their living off of the tourism and the, you know, the boat, the boats and the buses. They do hire some local people, and it's definitely helped, and the local guys, people supply the boat and fuel and stuff, so it's tourism has helped Eagle.
And more too, I see from year to year that a lot of Eagle residents are getting jobs on the boat too for the summer, and that is good.
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah. What draws new residents to Eagle, and what causes residents to leave?
I think they're drawn into Eagle when it's nice in the summertime, and they're leaving by wintertime. No, I think it's just, people want to, a lot of people are interested in wilderness and, laid back cultures and stuff, and this is one, but the climate can be harsh, let's face it. There's winters are tough here, and it's expensive to live here, groceries and gas, if you buy it locally, that's going to cost you a lot of money compared to, a lot of other places, even in Alaska. So not everybody can make it, and of course there isn't any really year-round economy here that people can tie into. There's a school that's that hires people. There's local merchant and park service, and limited jobs really.
I think too is that one of the things is that when you come to Eagle, it's beautiful, and you want to settle.
Yeah,
there.
Absolutely.
But by the time Eagle is what they call a limited community too, we don't have much facilities of anything. And one of the things is that people look to that for that too. And before too long, it's not like you go to even like Tokyo, you can go to a couple grocery stores or something.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I mean, the opportunities and the interests are not as great as some other towns,
Well, this flood really caused a lot of that to happen too, because it did take out a lot of the
old
community's infrastructure, and like we both know, it completely wiped out the old village, and it took the stores and everything out of Eagle. Now whether that comes back or not to the degree that people would like to see it, whether it's feasible, economically feasible, someone to really get back into that business or not, and that will dictate a lot in the future about whether people are going to stay here or not.
What is your opinion of the leadership of Eagle, and what ideas might you have?
By leadership, I'm assuming you mean the city council.
Well, anything, I think. Infrastructures within.
There's some real, there's some real civic leaders in Eagle, where the small community is. People that have always been here, or not always, but have been here for 35, 40 years, and they bought into the community and committed themselves to living in the community, and they've made the community go through the years, and it's good that those people are here.
What other historical events do you feel are important to Eagle's past?
Well, I know it's not very historical yet, but this breakup 2 years ago, really not only changed the structure of Eagle and the Eagle Village, but and going downriver, after we first went down there, when we got the boats in June, and we saw what it did to the a lot of the close in areas, as far as destroying trees and banks and everything, and wiping stuff up off the, that really changed everything. And it took a little while before you realized that this is the new normal as far as Eagle is concerned, in the river, at least. And I haven't been down all that far anymore, down Sheep Creek maybe, but I don't know how far that extends, but it's definitely changed.
Part two deals with subsistence and employment in Eagle. What kind of work have you done in the past while living in Eagle?
Well, I was a school teacher.
And retired.
Yeah, and I'm a retired school teacher, and I taught both in the village, and then I taught in the city of Eagle when the after the high school programs were put in place, and I was the principal of the school besides teaching. And basically, that's what I did. And when I worked on the when we lived downriver in the 70s, I used a riverboat. You know, I did some work for the fire service, and a couple times I'd haul people up and down the river between here and Circle, geologists and, you know, different people that were looking at the river and being on the river and so forth. So,
how would you describe employment opportunities in Eagle?
Limited. Limited. You know, that's what I said earlier. Basically, mm-hmm. You know, you've got just most of it's government. There's no doubt about that. You know, it's schools, it's the park service. You know, you have some state workers, the maintenance guys in state. You know, out in the village, you've got some people that work out there. But it is limited.
One of the things I see in this question that I can have a feedback from you is that I see that there are jobs within the school, within the village, within the National Park Service, the federal government. But for some of the locals to get a job, it's hard for them because they don't have the
expertise,
the background in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, through the local hire, you're supposed to be able to not only get into these fields, but to assist you in getting into
yeah.
to make you a, whether it's a biologist or whether it's a resource management. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
think that locks out a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah.
What does subsistence mean to you, and how do you participate in subsistence activity in the Eagle area?
Well, it's, through the years, it's meant different things, really, to me. Subsistence is, you know, living off what the land provides, and I think that, you know, as people as time has gone by, you know, subsistence isn't what it is. What it was 40, 50 years ago, but it's still there. I mean, people, even people who have a job and, you know, work in Fairbanks or work in Anchorage or Tok or whatever, and they come in here with a boat and motor and shoot a moose for their own use, that's really part of subsistence as far as I'm concerned. Now, it isn't subsistence to the point of, you know, you're down there living in a cabin on the riverbank, living off the land, but it's still subsistence. When we lived downriver, we lived a lot off what the land provided, you know. But we always bought stuff. I mean, we always had, you know, provisions, mm-hmm. Grains and meat, meals and sugar and all that kind of stuff, you know. But, you know, we raised vegetables and, you know, we shot moose and caribou and got a lot of king and dog salmon and berries, so.
I would like to note on this part right here is that fishing game, caribou, moose hunting, and all the graphs and all the research that I have seen is that a lot of that, because we live here, we are the local, and
mm-hmm.
but if you look at the graph, the majority of those that are utilizing the resource are non-local, and it's bigger percentage-wise.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And it could be because I guess I have to look at season too. Maybe you may be fishing, and you may miss that hunting season or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a thing I just like to elaborate, because it's just not only hunting for moose; it's hunting. It's also during the fishing season.
Right.
So
right.
You know, that's that has that.
Yeah.
Yeah. When do you hunt, fish, trap, collect, and why at this time of the year?
Well, basically, I just, you know, follow the seasons or the legal limit season or the, you know, the seasons according to the fishing game, and you know, that's in the fall, and We don't really pick berries much anymore, but we, you know, we fish. We still run a net and, you know, smoke and put up salmon in, when they're running, you know, as long as, and again, there again, you know, the runs haven't really been when they used, what they used to be, but when they allow us to fish, that's when we fish, so.
How have state federal regulations helped or hinder your subsistence activity?
I don't know. I think the regulations have been pretty decent. I mean, I think seasons and limits based on biological research and, you know, runs and people that know what they're doing, you know, they, you got to believe for the most part, you know, that's why they're doing what they are doing. As far as the Park Service, I've always been, I think the fact that their seasons are a little, they have seasons in, you know, other than the state does, and for local residents, I think that's always been a good deal. You know, I think that's good that they do that.
And a lot of these things in this. Regulations are the first thing is to begin to understand and know those regulations and what they mean, but at the same time we have to realize that it's in there for a purpose.
Yeah.
And not to hinder us in any of those activities.
Yep, I agree.
How have state and federal regulations affected community subsistence activities?
I don't know as they really have. Again, subsistence isn't what it once was, so it's not like people are really dependent on subsistence. It comes right down to that.
Here again, you know, is that subsistence, if we use the word as to how we come to understand it, is that one of the things I see is that the state caribou season, the quota has even been met and it's closed after so many years.
Yeah.
But what this one gives me, and I've seen it, is that it gives us opportunity later on to go into a subsistence zone within the federal management zone.
Yeah.
And we get ours. So we are actually, a lot of our caribou come within the 40 mile area, right in those subsistence zones.
Yeah.
So I think that is good for the community, you know. And a lot of this happens after the road closed.
Yeah, that's the best thing.
What ideas do you have for Eagle's economic stability?
Well, you know, I really don't have any because, you know, as far, there isn't enough, well, for one thing, there's no private land around here, and usually have, you know, economies based on really private land if you're going to develop a lasting economy to entice people, attract business or manufacturing. But the thing is, you know, we're out here a long way from anywhere, and there's nobody, unless somebody can set up something that is going to benefit from the river itself, you know. Otherwise, you know, again, I don't see any real long-term benefit, future for business in Eagle, except again the tourism and that sort of thing.
I thought you was going to tell me that you wanted like New York.
Yeah,
Do men and women do the same kind of work in Eagle, or do they tend to do different kinds of labor? How about in the past?
Boy, I don't know. I think in a lot of ways, you know, in a lot of ways, especially in the past, I think there's been men's activities and there's been women's activities, you know, and I don't think they were the same. Whether it's been back, you know, when your folks, you know, when those people were around, I think they still had divisions of labor, and I think it's pretty much that way today, although there's a lot of jobs that both men and women can do, and it's probably more so now than it ever was.
Well, what I like in this one is that right now a lot of women and a lot of men partake in the same labor activities. But at the same time, too, you know, we know that subsistence between a man and his wife, they both utilize their time because that's the way they feed their children. So, I mean, you look at it both ways, you know.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things we have to realize is we are at the end of the road. So, I mean,
that's right, yeah.
We may not have as much activity in job prospect as Tok will have, but we may get some kind of a project that somebody somewhere from the community will at least be part of, you know. Experience of flooding and climate change. Were you here in 1975? Can you tell me about what the land and weather was like?
Yep, I was. And I probably can. It was cold. I think 75, as I recall, was... I think that was the year, if I'm not mistaken, that it was one of the coldest winters on record. And I think, yeah. Yeah, and I remember one of those years we were on the 70-mile end, and I really believe, you know, I think there has been some moderation to the winters, to, you know, the weather, the climates during the winter. So that's climate change for sure, whether it's long-term, you know, whatever's going on, but we have noticed that the winters are not as severe. We don't get the really 55, 60 blows that we used to get that would stay a long time. You know, we might get those temperatures, but they really don't, they generally are pushed out by warmer fronts that are coming in from, you know, from the southwest, I guess, and come across the Gulf of Alaska, and then they're strong enough to get all the way in the interior, and it, you know, that never used to happen. They didn't have that much power. And so they get in and they warm the interior up more than they ever did before. Usually, you know, before, the weather would come, you know, from the north or from the northwest, and it was just a lot colder and it stayed for a lot longer periods of time. Plus, I think humans have learned to live a lot differently, you know, so they're warmer and their clothes are better, and, you know, everything else.
Were you here in 2000?
Can
you tell me about what the land and weather was like?
In 2000? I don't know. I mean, I can't offhand tell you.
Probably about the same as what you just told me, honestly.
Well, I think by 2000 things were, I think there was moderation, climate. But I do remember 75, the early 70s, and, you know, most of the 70s were cold. I do remember that.
Well, one of the things Kerry is saying here is that in 1975, or in the early 70s, and the 70 as a whole, was that we got a cold weather in November, and it stayed 2 months or sometime, 50, 60 below, whatever it took.
Yeah.
But now, we'll get it, but it's just that 2 or 3 days here and then.
Yeah.
And then it gets warm. Warm to us is 20 below.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. That's that's those warm fronts that come in here when they never used to do that. So,
were you here during the flood of 2009? What happened then, 2009?
Well, we were right here in this house for a little while. That was a perfect storm of conditions that led up to that flood, you know. Fall before, it was the river stopped, you know, once, and the water was really high. It froze over, and then it moved again, and a lot of ice piled up, and it piled up from shore to shore, and got really thick during the winter, and then during the spring it was really cool, and all of a sudden the water really started rushing over there, you know, rushing out of the hills in a short period of time. And the anchor ice was really thick, you know, that anchor ice that comes off the bank and froze all the way down to the bottom, and that was that went out a long way, and you know, until that anchor ice goes, the river doesn't go. There was just too much ice, and it just, you know, although there was a lot of water underneath there, it couldn't flush those jams out, and the only thing he'd do is back up and come over the riverbanks, and that's really where everybody was.
What do elders say about erosion, flooding, and storms?
I don't know. I really wouldn't. Outside of just having, you know, talk to them about all that stuff, I don't think there was anything there that I would remember or know that they thought there was any reasons for it one way or another.
I can elaborate just on this little one too, is that I know that there are some research that take up on the same thing. What the elders know, mm-hmm. What did they say? At that time, these questions were being asked by researchers and scholars and doctors coming into community. Well, they didn't want to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
The elders knew and said that in time, these things are coming.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, they describe it in their own way. That there is going to be a time when we meet these things, and what they actually said are now coming into being now. So the best way to say is these scholars and these researchers and doctors and these people that are doing the study are going back into some of these communities and say, wow, mm-hmm. This, you said this, but we didn't believe you, and now they're asking why. How has the community reacted to the flood in the past? Evaluation, moving house, protecting elders and kids.
Well, again, the only one I can really relate to is the flood of 2009, and I know the community, there's a lot of people lost their homes, and other people pitched in and, you know, helped move stuff out of the places that they knew once it started to back up, you know. They pitched in to help one another, try to, you know, get stuff in and out up to higher ground. That's the kind of thing that that happens, and then people do come together, you know, because they know they have to. And
do you notice change in temperature, snowfall, rain, rivers, lakes, or ponds in the local area?
Well, again, temperatures are, you know, they moderated from what they were over the last 30 years or so, 35 years. So the winters are warmer, although, you know, this winter has been, we've had some pretty steady minus 40s, you know, 45, 48. But then, you know, we still didn't get any of the real cold stuff, but we had weeks, you know, weeks where we would be in the minus 40s and stuff. So this was kind of a more of a typical winter, and we never did when it warmed up, and never did get up to where it was thawing very much, which has been happening in the past, you know, 10 or 20 years, so.
Please describe what the river and the region means to you in practical and personal terms.
Well, the river, you know, it's kind of a, I really, really like the river. The river's, you know, kind of gets in your blood and the surrounding country and the, you know, the hills and mountains. One thing about Eagle, you know, it's up here in the upper Yukon and there's a lot of bluffs, a lot of mountains, a lot of hills and for 100 miles, 120 miles downstream before it flattens out. And, you know, it's, there's very few people in it, you know, and so it's just nice to be out there. And, you know, if you're so inclined, I mean, a lot of people couldn't do that because they need more people around and they need more services and stuff. But in a lot of ways, even people in Eagle, a lot of people don't ever, you know, they see the river and they see all this, but they never leave the bank. I mean, they never go on the river, but a certain number of people do. And, you know, they're the ones with the boats and stuff. And, you know, they see the river for what it is, and that it's a great piece of real estate, really.
Part four, we're going to look at the Yukon Charlie Rivers National Preserve. And what is your overall opinion of the Yukon Charlie Rivers National Preserve?
Well, I guess, you know, I'd be one of the people in Eagle that, you know, I was here when the park was formed. I remember, you know, I remember when they first started talking about the park and, you know, back when the Anilka and all those, you know, everything was going on in the 70s. And I guess I'd say up front that I wish the park wasn't here, you know. I wish it would, you know, that it was like it always was, you know. But at some point, you know, you understand that there's things that beyond what you want or what you think should happen, and that's a case of the Yukon Charlie Preserve. I think that over the years that there's been clientele, people that work for the park and, you know, who's running the park, and there have been people that have really been, you know, kind of fit into the community, and people that have been hired out of the community to work for the park, and even people that have been sent in, the management, you know, part of the park, and which are meaningful people, and you can get along with them. There's other people that I wish that, you know, never were here or were never making decisions that were governing the park or policies or whatever. But, you know, overall, I think, you know, I guess I'd say I'm while not being happy with the park, I mean, I'm at least accepting the park, so.
What has been the most positive thing about the park preserve since its establishment?
I guess probably the fact that for the most part, when they have a low profile, you know, either on the river or in setting policy that's going to govern people that want to go into the park or down the Yukon, if they don't leave, if they basically leave people alone, when, you know, rather than just you know, getting involved in what people are doing simply because they have the right to do that, or they have to fulfill some plan somewhere to do it, you know, the less intrusion, the better. And, you know, again, there's been times that's been the way it is, and that's the way I think it should be, because I don't see the need for anything more than that, and I never have.
What has been the most negative thing about the preserve since its establishment?
Yeah, probably just the opposite from what I said. When there's too many people doing, you know, figuring they have to, you know, they have to govern, I guess. That they have to govern and involve themselves in things and in what's going on, and whether it's in the park, you know, or along the banks or in holders or people that are in the park, or, and it's not needed.
What do you know about people who live in the preserve since its establishment, and what was their opinion of the preserve? If you know, are you willing to share it?
You mean with people that were in the preserve? Well, it hasn't been that many that I know. There's a whole bunch of dog teams or something down there.
Okay, the fifth question I would ask you is, do you make use of the preserve for hunting, fishing, trapping, or any other activity?
Hunting. Yeah, I still go into the park, or I still am, you know, some of the administered grounds sometimes, so my net sites in front of native allotment, and I don't trap anymore, but I do go in the park for hunting. Hunting moose in the fall.
What advice do you have concerning the preserve and its management?
I don't know. To go back to one of those other questions, probably the less management the better, as far as still fulfilling their, you know, their policy requirements, or, you know, that sort of thing. But I really don't see a lot of tourist traffic that goes to the park in the summer, I don't know. Of course, you know, I'm also speaking from this end of the park. I don't know how much impact on the park comes up from Circle, you know, or flies into different parts of the park. But I think the less management, the better.
Can you describe any of the trails in the area, and what do you know about their use in the past and present?
Of trails?
Just most of you are familiar with that.
Well,
the old mail trail, because
the mail trails, all, you know, down to all the way down to Nation where they were. Yeah. And I used to be on some of them, you know. Mainly I was on the ones down as far into the Teutonic River, because I think the one from across from where Dick Cook used to live on, that used to come out across below, go across there and come out before below Montauk Bluff and then go on the Circle, that one was, I think, fired. You know, I mean, the fire got in there and no one ever really cut it out anymore. But yeah, I still, you know, the one here from Boulder down across Ford Lake, and then the one across Lord Lake, which was also burned out. Those were beautiful trails. I mean, I enjoyed them immensely.
Okay, part five, we deal with the future of Eagle. When you think about the future of Eagle, what do you see?
I don't, you know, as far as the Eagle community, you mean? I don't see that much. I don't see that much difference here. I don't see that much happening, unless, you know, again, there's facilities that are developed here, more facilities for tourism or whatever. I can't see population growth here based on, again, the fact that there's really nothing for people to do economically, job-wise.
Can you think about and then list infrastructures you would want in the city, in Eagle?
Think about what less
infrastructures you would want in the. It says village, but or Eagle. Or Eagle City.
Well, you know, right now Eagle community doesn't even have a cafe. You know, we're since the flood, and whether that ever comes back or not, it's, you know, something like that is nice to have at least in the summer, and for people to gather and, you know, go have coffee in the morning or something. But. Whether that becomes a reality or not, I don't know. If it does, I'm sure it'll be based on the potential of tourism, the fact that if the boat keeps running, you know, which again also depends on whether the Taylor Highway stays intact so buses can come in, and Now, that remains to be seen, but...
Can you think about... Excuse me. There has been a lot of talk about sustainability. Can you tell me what that means to you?
Sustain, I don't really know what that means.
Sustainability, that's probably something that is going to be here for preserve, with that and preserve or something.
Well, the potential for that, or that it might...
It might be bigger, might be...
Yeah, I can't, I think of it as it was going to, I was going to guess, you know, I think it was going to, it'll be remain kind of like it is right now. You know, which is, I think it'll sustain itself with what's here right now.
Okay. Are you interested in alternative energy source in Eagle?
Oh, yeah, I'd be interested in that.
Do you have any ideas about the future of Eagle and where it needs to go?
A lot of these are questions are kind of repetitious, you know.
Yep.
I don't really. It'd be nice, you know. It'd be nice to see Eagle get to the point where even what we had back in the 80s, you know, when at one time we had 40 some kids in school. There's a lot of people around, you know, land values are up. But I think a lot of that was an outgrowth of, you know, the oil pipeline in the state of Alaska, you know, had a lot of money, you know, to pump out into the villages. But right now, you know, values aren't that much, land values aren't that much. And again, I don't see any of that changing in the foreseeable future.
Okay, Terry, thank you, and I think you have any other questions for me?
No,
okay,
I appreciate it.
Right at the moment, too, because the prerequisite of the Yukon Charlie National Parks, the preserve, has been some of the preservation of some of the lifestyles that has gone in it, or the hunting, fishing, trapping, subsistence, and the living and the utilizing of all these renewable resources.
Mm-hmm.
But I know too that many of us keep forgetting that dog teams, dogs, old mail route, or the mail trail. And Terry, one of the interesting things has been both in the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest. So I like to talk to him on that and ask him some questions. And this will help substantiate some of his interview. I'll put another